You may have noticed a double S in the heart shape, but in the background. All right, okay, I'll keep going. But it just reminded me when my attention was drawn to that godly passion has God's fingerprints all over it. It's nothing to do with our ego or style or anything else. It's about his passion and having his fingerprints on it. And the underlying verse throughout our series has been from Romans 12. Never be lacking in zeal, but keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Keep your spiritual fervor serving the Lord. Not passion for passion's sake, but passion with a purpose behind it. I just want to do a brief resume on where we have been. And by the way, thanks to everybody who has participated in the past 8 weeks. We began with Elijah, which was about our passion for God, and from which all other passions will stem. And then you no doubt will remember this. Yes? Yes? Good. Right, our voting card. And Steve did passion for what we believe, not just about what, but why we believe what we believe. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. Hartmut followed on for passion for the Word of God, meditating on the Word of God. He said that for him it had begun 43 years ago, and I think that's probably time enough to test it out, don't you? Margaret followed that with passion for the church, not just in the church, but for the church, the body through which we express our passion, our 24-hour prayer event. These graphics that we've been using all the time were all around the building, if you can recall. And the final station, if you got to number 13, you may have read these words. They impacted me tremendously. What you've experienced here can't just stay here. It's not the end. It may have been the final prayer station, but it's not the end. John then, the other week, passion in living, our reason for being, what dominates our existence. And he took us a journey into the sad world of certain philosophers. And doing quite a bit of philosophy over the past 2 or 3 years, they are sad. Matt then, passion in the everyday. He took us also on a different kind of journey into social media and some of the statistics that are involved around social media. A passion in the ordinary bits between the exciting bits. That's what he was talking about. Our everyday passionately matters to God. The ordinary, the mundane. And our series is not meant to be an 8-week course in passion, so that, right, we've gone through it now, we get a certificate and everything's okay. All it is really meant to do is light your blue touch paper, but not retire, okay? Just light the blue touch paper. What you've experienced here can't just stay here. It's not the end. We're going back to Elijah this morning, and his is about passion that is obedience. The word passion is a noun. I understand that in some languages, nouns can be masculine or feminine. In Spanish, for instance, house is feminine. I've no idea why, but it is la casa. Pencil is masculine, el lápiz. And the teacher was trying to explain this kind of difference to her class. She was teaching them Spanish, because English has no such designations. And so her class, very conveniently, was 50% male, 50% female, so she divided them in half and said, right, I want you to do this exercise to decide whether computer was male or female. Now, I was going to put that out to No, it's not question time, not yet. Okay, because that could go on forever. The men's group decided that computer was definitely female. La computadora. Because no one but their creator understands their logic. The native language they use to communicate with other computers is incomprehensible to everyone else. Even the smallest mistakes are stored in long memory for possible retrieval. And as soon as you make a commitment to one, you'll find yourself spending half your salary on accessories for it. The women's group, however, concluded that computers should be male, el computador, because in order to do anything with them, you have to turn them on. They have a lot of data, but still can't think for themselves. It's funny where the different laughter is coming from this morning, eh? They are supposed to solve problems, but half the time, they are the problem. And as soon as you commit to one, you realize that if you had waited a little longer, you could have obtained a better model. I leave it with you. I have no idea. But there are different words for passion which carry the same meaning, and these words are called synonyms. Words different but with the same meaning. And some of those words are these: dedication and devotion, intensity and agony, fire and indignation, rapture — I don't mean the silly doctrine that flies around — and suffering. And it's all an indication that passion doesn't come cheap. It's not all surface froth and whoopee. There's something far, far deeper than that. Elijah is having woman trouble. And the woman in question is King Ahab's wife Jezebel, and not even a computer can find a noun to describe this one, believe you me. She is one nasty piece of work by anybody's standard. Elijah even prophesies her ignominious end. And if you read 2 Kings 9, you find that she is thrown from a tower, she is trampled by horses and eaten by dogs. It's a kind of a poetic end, really, to somebody who had trampled on everybody else on her way up. And now when she really does hit the floor, she gets trampled on herself. You recall the showdown that there was on Mount Carmel, where there were 450 prophets of Baal. They set up an altar. They put the sacrifice on it. No fire was lit underneath it. And Elijah said this: "You call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire is indeed God." And against all the odds, he wins. The problem is that Jezebel loses faith, and loses face as well. Hans Christian Andersen wrote a little fairy tale about the emperor's new clothes. You remember? Some shysters came along and conned him into believing that he got some very lovely material, and he went out in it. Of course, he was stark naked. One little boy in the crowd says, "Ha, the king's got no clothes on." And then everybody realized that they'd all been fooled. Elijah is the little boy in the crowd who sees what really is, instead of being conned by everybody else. This is a man with a passion for God, and a man who sees what is. And to quote from Revelation, that they were wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. That was how he saw the state of his nation Israel. Of course, Jezebel didn't show up for the showdown on Mount Carmel, did she? And Ahab relays the result to her, and she has lost face. And I'm sure you're well averse with the phrase that says, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned." And my, Elijah was going to discover that kind of hell for himself. Of course, she doesn't threaten personally. We'll have a read, shall we? 1 Kings 19, and the first 13 verses. It will come up on the screen, won't it? Yeah, right. Can we read this together, do you think, please? 1 Kings 19 and from the first verse then. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid. He got up and fled for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. He left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree. He asked that he might die. "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. Suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, "Get up and eat." He looked, and there at his head was a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. He ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came a second time, touched him, and said, "Get up and eat, otherwise the journey will be too much for you." He got up and ate and drank. Then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. At that place he came to a cave and spent the night there. Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He answered, "I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts. For the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." He said, "Go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Now there was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind, and after the wind an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake, and after the earthquake a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire, and after the fire a sound of sheer silence. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Then there came a voice to him that said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Jezebel doesn't threaten Elijah personally. She sends a messenger. I guess if this was last week's sermon, she would have sent a text. Although she would not have carried out the threat personally, she would have got her hands dirty. Elijah is well aware that this threat is not an empty threat at all. His life is now being threatened. James, in his epistle, one of the few that mentions Elijah in the New Testament, says Elijah was a human being, even as we are. And passion is not exempt from vulnerability. He runs. He runs for his life, and he runs a very vast distance. If you want to try to check up, if you've got some decent maps in the back of your Bible, it's somewhere in excess of 330 miles. It's a long way. It's crisis time. It would be remiss and inappropriate to conjecture what his emotional state is at this point. And neither can we assume what happens to a mind when it goes into this kind of turmoil. It's crisis time. They occur, they happen, and they can hurt. And they can hurt like hell when they happen. We can't afford to be too romantic or have a too romantic an idea about such characters as Elijah. These things happen. And they happen to the best of people from time to time. And we have to come to terms with the fact that they happen. They happen to John the Baptist. Just read Luke 7 carefully and you'll find out. Listen to what Paul says. We don't think of him as being in this kind of condition. In 2 Corinthians 1, he says, "We do not want you to be unaware, brothers and sisters, of the affliction we experienced in Asia. For we were so utterly, unbearably crushed that we despaired of life itself. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death." Can you hear Elijah? "We felt that we had received the sentence of death so that we could rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead." This is mental and emotional agony. And it's not uncommon. We hear an awful lot through the media these days about mental illnesses. Some are and some are not. But it's not uncommon. The 18th century hymn writer William Cowper wrote some beautiful words that says, "Oh, for a closer walk with God, a calm and heavenly frame, a light to shine upon the road that leads me to the Lamb." But then he gets to verse 2. How long a time there was between verse 1 and verse 2, I've no idea. But he says, "Where is the blessedness I knew when first I knew the Lord? Where is the soul-refreshing view of Jesus and his word?" Here is a man who wrote a lot of beautiful hymns, but he suffered periods of severe depression. 16th century Carmelite St. John of the Cross described experiences like this as the dark night of the soul. Beautiful phrase, but drastic. It's a metaphor for abject loneliness and desolation. And nobody but nobody would place themselves there willingly. And Jezebel is a reminder of the power of the one. We need to guard our lips, because it is sometimes so easy to say things that we think, as the phrase goes, "Well, it must be said." No, it mustn't be said. You just want to say it. This is the power of the one. I'm not quite sure what the ratio is, but if you are encouraged by a certain number of people, I think it's about 12 or something like that, but you get criticized by one, which is the one that you remember. This is the power of the one. And it's the damage that the one can do. When the darkness descends, any question, though, of what or who may have caused it becomes enveloped in that darkness, and all that matters really is you. Strange thing is, God does not deter Elijah or prevent him from making his escape. He lets him go. And it occurs in stages: a day's journey to Jezreel, from Jezreel to Beersheba, then into the wilderness. He leaves his servant there and he's on his own. Absolutely on his own. And some strange things happen. He says at one point, "I've had enough. I just want to die." And at that he falls asleep. He has two angelic encounters and he's fed twice, but he seems quite impervious to the kind of intervention that is happening. But despite his emotional state, and this is something we need to grasp a hold of, despite his emotional or even his mental state, God has not left him. God is still there with him. A 40-day journey follows this, and he arrives at Horeb, and he finds himself a cave, a man cave. He's not being super spiritual. He's not pretending to be more than a conqueror and "I can do all things through him who strengthens me." He's a man, a human being, even as we are, says James. Prophets are human, very human. But there is a very strange but priceless irony here, because where he arrives at, the mountain that he arrives at, Horeb, is also known as Mount Sinai. It's the very mountain where Moses encounters the burning bush. It's the same place where, after he has brought the Hebrews out of Egypt, it's there that they encounter God and receive the Ten Commandments and the law. Where can I go from your Spirit? This is where our service began last week. Where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I settle in the farthest limits of the sea, you are there. And if I find an obscure cave on the side of a mountain, guess what? You're there as well. Because Elijah just needs to regain his perspective. And it's not that things are always wrong. It can be our perspective that needs adjusting, because it so often gets a little bit skewed. And if perspective is lost when things are wrong, then they can seem doubly wrong to what they actually are. And from inside the cave, he hears from outside the wind and the earthquake and the fire. The strange thing is, it's the very same effects that were heard at Mount Sinai before. Remember, Moses there, Israel there, the noise is from the mount, and the very same thing. But he discovers this about his God, that he's not bound by precedent. He doesn't have to do the same thing in the same way twice. God is a God of ultimate and infinite variety. I'm told that when snowflakes fall, and it's not quite the weather to be talking about it, but when snowflakes fall, there are not two that are the same. I don't know how they prove that, but I just have to take it that, yeah, okay. But you only have to look at people. We are more or less the same, with all the same bits in the same places, well, more or less. And if you just look above the shoulders, about the same head shape, with all the same bits in the same places, again, more or less, but a little tweak here and there, and a little touch here and there, how we become quite different, don't we? And that means that when God made Joe, he took one look at us, stood back and said, "Oh, I'm not doing that again." He's not bound by precedent. Wind, earthquake, fire, but God is not in them this time. And then one translation says a still small voice, another one a gentle whisper, but the one we read this morning said a sound of sheer silence. Nothing dramatic. No big whoopee's going on now. The loudest thing I would imagine in that cave was Elijah's heartbeat and the sound of his own breathing. And that can be frightening. But there's a strange paradox, because it said, when Elijah heard it, when he heard the sound of sheer silence, how do you hear sheer silence? The kind of silence that drowns out everything else. Because into that silence, sheer silence, into the dark night of his soul, God speaks. Carlo Coretto says, God's call is mysterious. It comes in the darkness of faith. It is so fine, so subtle, that it is only with the deepest silence within us that we can hear it. The deepest silence within us. The Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein, they're not all miserable so-and-sos, John. He says, you can't hear God speak to someone else. You can hear him only when you are being addressed. You can't hear God speak to someone else. You can hear him only if you are being addressed. The one being addressed hears it how they need to hear it. What are you doing here, Elijah? There is no indication as to whether there is any inflection in God's voice or whether there is any emphasis placed on any word. But the one being addressed hears it how they need to hear it. And when Elijah hears that, I think we can be pretty well assured he heard it how he needed to hear it. What went on in the rest of the time in the silence, how long he was there, what the entire conversation was, we do not know. But I would imagine that there was a bit more. But you see, God reserves the right to keep some things to himself. And the things he keeps to himself are kept to himself because they are none of our business, that's why. And there in that cave, stuff was going on because things had to change. But what we do know is what we've got in the text, that twice the same question and twice an identical answer. One from inside the cave, the second from the entrance to the cave. And from inside the cave, he hears all those noises that are going on the outside. And then God calls him to the outside of the cave. This is more than just a man leaving a venue. He's doing more than just going outside of the cave. He goes and stands in the entrance and he hears the same question again. You see, he thinks he's the only one left, the only prophet of God left. His passions have taken a battering. There's no doubt about that. And faith and passion very often do for us take a hammering. Because life sucks sometimes, doesn't it? It really does. But be assured of this, that whatever hammering your faith and your passion may have taken, your standing before God does not change one iota. Just because you feel differently, just because stuff has happened to you, your standing before God doesn't change. And Elijah hides his face in his cloak. This is more than a cloak. This is his mantle. This is his insignia of office, if you like, because a prophet of his day would have had a certain type of mantle to wear. And so he wraps it around his face to go out to stand at the entrance to the cave. But you see, he also discovers this, that God doesn't deal in status and with image and facade and all the rest of it. God deals with the person inside. And here, at the entrance of a cave, no, God doesn't go in the cave. No, you come out here, Elijah. You come and meet with me. And he's dealing with a deeply hurt man. And in this sheer silence, the restoration of a crushed human being begins. No fanfare, no drama, but something deep within Elijah's heart, a restoration begins. Something is being settled, which can only be settled in his aloneness with God, because his aloneness with God is the only place, not just the best place, not just the appropriate place, but the only place to be. If you go forward several years, you find another man in a garden called Gethsemane, and the aloneness with God is the only place to be. The writer to the Hebrews records it like this: in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to the one who was able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Although he was a son, he learned obedience. Ever think of that? Jesus actually learned obedience. Go back 30-odd years. Well, no, 20-odd years, and they find him in Jerusalem as a 12-year-old boy, and it says he went back and he was in submission to his parents. Totally God, totally man, and the man bit had to learn stuff. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And the obedience that day was not my will, but yours. That place of aloneness. It's probably something we all, from time to time, have to discover. But Elijah gets a triple commission at this point. 1 Kings 19, 15 and 16. You go back, you anoint Hazael king of Aram, and Jehu king over Israel. And by the way, Now that I've got your attention, just a couple of other things. There are 7,000 others that haven't bowed their knee to Baal, so you're not the only one. Don't feel so sorry for yourself. And, by the way, your replacement is waiting. Ooh, anoint Elisha as prophet in your place. Only one of these he carries out, which I think is something related to his character. The other two, the anointing of the two kings, he leaves to his successor. Remember what those synonyms of passion were? Intensity and agony and suffering. But passion also means obedience. Go back the way you came. Not just the route. You don't have to go exactly on the same road. And this is not just about getting him back to where he was, back to where it was all familiar, but back to where he needed to be. Back to where he was needed. You see, whenever we need to make a spiritual journey like this, God seldom takes us from A to Z in one go, because I don't think any of us could handle it. Restoration is a gradual and very gentle process, because the restoration is about the healing of this damaged man. And the journey to Horeb was one in desperation, in fear of his life, but the return is more calculated, it's more measured, it's more deliberate. And he needs to know that he was and still is part of God's purpose. What you've experienced here, said our prayer station, can't just stay here. It's not the end. Oh, maybe Elijah heard those words, I don't know. What you've experienced here in your cave, Elijah, is not the end. Can't just stay here. Doesn't end here. And no matter what time he's got left, it's going to take a different kind of passion to the passion that he knew before. And his obedience is demonstrated in his willingness to serve someone else's passion. Elisha is to be his successor. And Elisha is described in 2 Kings as he used to pour water on the hands of Elijah. That is just an analogy of a servant. Elisha was Elijah's servant. Now Elijah becomes Elisha's servant. He returns to serve the man who once served him. The Son of Man, says Mark, came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. The strapline on our graphic over these past few weeks has said this: living a Jesus-centered life. Our passion and our obedience is seen in serving the one who came to serve. Serving the one who came to serve. And I think this morning it's only appropriate that we conclude our series on passion and engage in that which celebrates the ultimate act of passion, this act of communion. This was just the beginning of that, what we call Passion Week, where the full passion of Jesus was expressed. But it's an indication that whatever our passion might be, it's only legitimate when it is expressed out of love and out of obedience for God. Let's just be silent for a few moments, and then we shall prepare ourselves for our time of communion.